Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the killing of two Western hostages by a CIA drone strike in Pakistan led some U.S. media to re-engage debate over U.S. drone policy. But media's discussion is over how and where drones should be used, not whether they should be. We'll talk to law professor Marjorie Cohn, author of, most recently, Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Also on the show, sometimes called the Green Nobel, the Goldman Environmental Prize is given to grassroots environmental activists from each of six world regions. This year's winners, including Honduran indigenous rights leader Berta Cáceres and the group COPIN, are fighting not just governments, but some of the world's most powerful corporations to protect their land and livelihood. That's why Cáceres and her colleagues face death threats and repression, and it has something to do with why you can read all of the U.S. media coverage of Cáceres and the Goldman Prize in the time of an elevator ride. We'll hear from Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds about that story. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Protests erupted in Baltimore over the death of a black man named Freddie Gray, who suffered a severe spinal cord injury either upon his April 12th arrest or in the police van. As of April 30th, police still have not explained how that happened or why they arrested him. So, media had yet another opportunity to interrogate systemic racial injustices in policing practices, to examine the other structural problems, decades of underinvestment, job loss, and housing discrimination that fuel these outbursts of public resistance. And, yet again, many in major media opted instead for focus on property damage and pearl-clutching about thugs and looters, while the voices and ideas of those protesting were engaged mainly by the everyday more necessary social and independent media. We'll let one example count for many. The Washington Post offered readers a primer April 28th, the basic information the paper thinks you need to know to understand what's happening. The Who Was Freddie Gray section was drawn from the No Angel school of journalism, with the paper's stress on Gray's previous run-ins with the law, offset by friends' remembrance of him as loyal and warm. It reads creepily as though we're meant to decide from this whether Gray was the sort of person who deserved to live or die. There's a choice, too, in the Post description of Gray as, quote, the nation's most prominent symbol of distrust in police, close quote, where many would say he symbolizes black people's harm at police hands. In a How Did He Die section, sourced entirely to police and other officials, the Post presents Gray's death as a complete mystery and refers to officers' choices to leave Gray, who bystander video shows being dragged limp to the police van, unseatbelted, to fail to call an ambulance on arrest, as policy requires, and to refuse medical assistance when it was repeatedly requested, as errors. Well, having presented a story of a maybe kinda criminal guy who somehow accidentally died, the Post's final question is less surprising. Why is there so much anger? Well, implicitly, the fact that police appear to have killed someone in a terrible fashion with no credible explanation is deemed insufficient grounds. But the Post explains Gray's death is linked to, quote, what activists say is a much larger national issue, police mistreatment of black men, close quote. And these tensions, we're told, have been, quote, heightened in West Baltimore, where relations between residents and police have long been strained, close quote. An ACLU of Maryland report found 109 people killed in police encounters in the state in just the last 5 years, 69% of whom were black. Maryland is 29% black. 45 victims were not armed in any way. 80% of those people were black. When outlets like The Post can engage that reality, the reasons it happens and is allowed to happen, without downplaying it with terms like tensions and strain, then we'll believe they're learning to report as though black lives mattered. Oral arguments began in the Supreme Court's consideration of the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. Outlets, including the New York Times, have editorially embraced marriage equality. But that doesn't mean their straight reporting, no pun intended, can't undermine it, as with the Paper of Record's April 28th piece. Like many, the story reported statements by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy and Scalia that legalizing same-sex marriage means changing a definition of marriage that, in Kennedy's words, quote, has been with us for millennia, close quote. The Times recounts Roberts' claim to have looked up definitions of marriage and found none written before a dozen years ago that did not define it as unity between a man and a woman. Now, there's a saying that one is entitled to one's own opinions, but not one's own facts. So it's hard to see how the Times can simply report such patently false statements without comment. Numerous societies, of course, practiced polygamy. Men in the Bible, one would think rather famously, could have more than one wife if they could support them. Where monogamy existed, it was defined differently, sometimes meaning one spouse in a lifetime, sometimes just one at a time. And of course, far from Roberts' unity, heterosexual marriage was for many, many years largely a business transaction with men absorbing women's assets. The supposedly never-changing institution didn't legally include people of different races in this country until 1967, or in Alabama, 2000. In short, saying marriage has been defined the same way for millennia is akin to saying the Constitution was signed in 1985 and should be treated similarly by reporters. And finally, after a weather disaster, you'll sometimes read stories asking, was this hurricane or this drought or this tornado caused by global warming? It's a pointless question because all weather events are part of one global climate, and that climate has been irrevocably altered by human-caused global warming. But attempting this illogical parsing does allow you to murk up the fact that climate change is already causing real damage in the world. This fallacy found its way into an otherwise solid story in the April 27th New York Times by Justin Gillis, which began, quote, "The moderate global warming that has already occurred as a result of human emissions is responsible for about 75% of daily heat extremes and about 18% of precipitation extremes," scientists reported Monday, close quote. You see the implication that there are some hot days and some wet days that are the result of global warming and others that are not. But again, all weather takes place in the context of an altered climate that changes the odds to make some kinds of weather more likely and some less. Well, the good news here is that after Fair pointed out these problems on Twitter, the Times changed the article to read that global warming had, quote, quadrupled the frequency of certain heat extremes, close quote. That's a much clearer way to frame the story that doesn't encourage shrugging off weather disasters as maybe tied to climate change, but maybe not. And so for that, we're thankful. We're thankful also that you're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The April 26th Wall Street Journal reported that Barack Obama had secretly approved a waiver that loosened rules governing CIA drone strikes in Pakistan. This, of course, in the wake of the White House admission that a January 15th strike that killed two Western hostages, an American and an Italian, was a so-called signature strike that doesn't target individuals, much less those known to be imminent threats, but facilities believed to harbor terrorists. That U.S. media's interest in drone policy would be spurred by the deaths of Westerners was as predictable as it is myopic. But is what we're being told is a renewed debate on drone policy really touching on the core problems with what CNN described as this highly effective and sometimes imperfect weapon? Joining us to discuss the issue is Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and deputy secretary general of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing: Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Welcome back to Counterspin, Marjorie Cohn.
My pleasure, Janine.
Well, the idea seems to be that, as the Journal put it, if the exemption had not been in place for Pakistan, the CIA might have been required to gather more intelligence before that strike that killed those two Westerners, and that this represents a special and outrageous breach of the promises Obama made about tightening restrictions on the use of drones. The political media response to all of this is to call for control of drone policy to move from the CIA to the Defense Department. Are the problem or the answer here being defined satisfactorily to your mind?
Not at all. It's not just a question of moving away from the CIA, although certainly the CIA can't be trusted, since the same people at the CIA were also responsible for the torture program. And the recent Senate report, the intelligence report, showed that the CIA was lying about what they were doing with the torture program. But it's much deeper than that. It's the entire targeted killing program that Obama is prosecuting. He defines the whole world as a battlefield and reserves the right to kill anyone he wants in any country he wants through drones and other methods. That's illegal. And not only is it illegal, it's also immoral, and it violates due process, which is not just enshrined in our Constitution, but also in international treaties that we've ratified. And due process means that you arrest someone and give them a fair trial. Yet, Obama has this, really what it is an assassination program, where people are put on a kill list on Terror Tuesdays, and there are two different kinds of strikes. There's a personality strike, which targets individuals, and signature strikes, which is what this was, as you said, targeting suspicious compounds in areas controlled by militants. They don't even know who they're killing. They do have rules that they came up with in 2013. There was a fact sheet that was released as Obama was speaking to the National Defense University about drone strikes, yet they're not even following these rules. The rules, for example, require a legal basis for the use of lethal force, nothing about complying with the UN Charter, for example, which is a treaty and therefore part of U.S. domestic law, and that UN Charter prohibits the use of military force except in self-defense. The target must pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons, and yet a leaked Department of Justice white paper says that a U.S. citizen can be killed even where there's no clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future. And if there is such a low bar for U.S. citizens to be targeted, there's probably no bar at all for people who are not U.S. citizens. Then there must be a near certainty that the terrorist target is present. But how do you know who the terrorist target is if it's a signature strike, which is also known as a crowd killing, killing groups of individuals? And then there must be a near certainty that non-combatants will not be killed. Well, the Obama administration defines combatants as all men of military age in a strike zone unless there is explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. So how can they possibly comply with that? Then there must be an assessment that capture is not feasible. If you read further, it looks like infeasible means inconvenient. And also, Obama has said he's not going to comply with these guidelines in his fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And even if he were following the rules, we should not be killing people off the battlefield in targeted killing. That is illegal under international law.
Well, let me ask you, William Salatin at Slate said that for civilians, drones are the safest form of war in modern history. They're discriminating and more accurate. And he said, if you want to minimize civilian casualties, getting rid of drones and steering warfare back to bombing and shelling is the worst thing you could do. Now, for me, the sleight of hand there, or the fallacy, is this idea that opposition to drones entails a call for carpet bombing, you know, when I think the sense of many people is that we're waging more wars than we might if those wars could not be sold as surgical. So we're not saving hypothetical civilians beyond the perhaps 900 killed, for example, in Pakistan. We're really just killing those civilians. But I wonder what you make of this line that, you know, in fact, drones are the safest weapon in terms of civilian casualties.
Well, that is a popular notion, that drones result in fewer civilian casualties than manned bombers, but a study based on classified military data, which was conducted by the Center for Naval Analyses and the Center for Civilians in Conflict, found that the use of drones in Afghanistan had caused 10 times more civilian deaths than manned fighter aircraft. And, you know, I think we need to question the whole assumption that we need to be killing at all, killing people in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, and there are probably other places as well. What are we doing killing all those people over there?
Yes, the Slate line seems to be, and it's not just this person at Slate, the line seems to be, you're saying you want to wage a war on terror with the whole world as a battlefield, but you don't want to use drones? And we're saying no, you know, no to all of that. I really can't forgive media for signing off on the idea of terror as an enemy, you know, like the Spartans at Thermopylae, and yet at the same time something that can lurk latent in the hearts of people. I almost feel that once media accepted war on terror as a war like World War II, the confusion was predictable, you know.
I agree. And the drone strikes actually are counterproductive as well. They create more enemies for the United States. They make us less safe, not more safe. They make us more vulnerable to terrorism. When Faisal Shassad was pleading guilty to trying to detonate a bomb in Times Square, he told the judge, when the drones hit, they don't see children. So we see this blowback from our drones where people see their loved ones being killed, tribal leaders being killed. There are reports that less than 2% of the people killed by American drones were high-level al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders. It really is counterproductive, not just illegal and immoral, and drones ought to be outlawed, actually.
We've been speaking with Marjorie Cohn. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. And you can find her article, Double Standards and Drones, at consortiumnews.com. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure, Janine. Thank you.
The Goldman Environmental Prize is, among other things, an opportunity for media to explore particular stories from around the world as represented by the work and struggles of the grassroots activists the prize spotlights each year. It's overwhelmingly a missed opportunity, though, and 2015 looks like no exception. Corporate media disinterest may be related to the fact that serious, deep reporting of the lives of people like Honduran indigenous rights activist Berta Cáceres and her group COPIN, one of this year's recipients, requires an unflinching look at the powerful governments and corporations that repress people like Cáceres, often violently, in an effort to get at the natural resources in their communities. Beverly Bell is coordinator of the group Other Worlds and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's worked and traveled with Berta Cáceres and the group COPIN, the National Council of Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, for many years. Welcome to Counterspin, Beverly Bell.
Thank you, Janine. I'm so glad to be here, and especially for the wonderful opportunity to highlight this amazing, amazing movement in Honduras that so few people in the U.S. are aware of.
Well, yes, and looking into it, I found virtually nothing about Berta Cáceres or COPIN in the major U.S. media, a San Francisco Chronicle piece, a Fox News Latino piece, and a mention in a Tribune Wire piece about Mian Zaw, another recipient. So I imagine that many listeners really don't know much about her or her work. Can you tell us what Berta Cáceres and COPIN do that earns them both death threats in Honduras and the Goldman Environmental Prize?
First, just to underscore what you said, that the Goldman Prize, which is considered the Green Nobel Prize, it's the largest prize in the world for environmental justice activists. Five of the six recipients this year were members of movements who were fighting corporate extraction and mega development projects on their land. So you're right, it is no surprise that the mainstream press has overlooked this. But for us, it is a huge victory. all of us who care about what's happening in Honduras and all of us who care about fighting the role of the U.S., which in Honduras is utterly central, Honduras being basically the prime client state of the U.S. government in Central America, a role it has played for many years. But to tell you about Berta, first to say Berta is an extraordinary woman. She was raised by a very, very radical mother in a small town in Honduras. Her mother was mayor and then governor of the state. And Berta grew up listening to clandestine revolutionary radio from Cuba and Nicaragua. They had to go into an inner room and close the doors to listen because they would have been arrested. But she was radicalized at a very early age and came to understand the roots of the repression and the U.S. domination that Honduras has, as I said, lived under for a long time. She started this group, COPIN, which is composed of Lenca indigenous and other rural-based peoples, about 20 years ago. The group has been stunning in its victories. For example, they are the first group that ever got the Honduran law changed to grant communal title instead of individual land titles, which allows for collective indigenous ownership. And then they went on to win many, many cases of land being granted to their peoples where the land had previously been stolen. They have virtually cleared Lenca lands of outside logging operations. They've actually stopped, through direct action, 36 logging and sawmills, and now the loggers don't even try to go into their lands anymore. They got one large community declared a protected area, and that's pretty much unheard of. They were among those who won the provision in the Honduran Constitution to free prior and informed consent by the government before any extraction or development projects get installed on their land. Well, of course, this has not been respected, but it is a huge victory on the books. They also were very key in getting Mel Zelaya, the president that the U.S. helped overthrow in 2009. And incidentally, in Hillary Clinton's new book, she does confirm the role of the U.S. in that coup, and there's a lot of other evidence. But one of the reasons for that coup was that COPIN was so influential in pushing Zelaya to support land reform. And that just completely freaked out the oligarchy that has pretty much run Honduras. And so they said, no, wait, we can't live in a country where grassroots peoples have the power to take our land away. And that was one of the big factors behind the coup. Oh, I could go on and on and on about their victories. But there's one for which she won the award, and I will say that she and COPIN won it. And just a parenthetical, Goldman is very much a product of the U.S. culture, where we choose to look at individual action. But Berta Cáceres herself would never have accomplished any of this. It was all done, yes, with her extraordinary leadership, but through the tens of thousands of people who comprise COPIN. And what happened in this case that actually won her the award is in a small Lenca community called Rio Blanco, the indigenous peoples woke up one morning and basically there were bulldozers and other heavy equipment going over their bean fields and making their way to the sacred Huacatque River, where they began installing the infrastructure for a dam. This was totally illegal. The river was owned, as much as water can be owned, by that community, and yet they proceeded. So Berta and COPIN fought for quite a while, and no one heard them until they said, to heck with this, we'll just take direct action, which is something that COPIN is great at. So they set up a roadblock, and they cut a trench in the land, and every day, for a very long time, every member of the community, from the smallest babies to the eldest, went down and stood in front of that roadblock. And all of us collectively, the big movement part of it, were able to get some international attention and international pressure. And the Honduran government, which was behind this dam, and the company that is partly owned by a Honduras man who, by the way, is a West Point graduate. The U.S. military has a role all the way through here. responded with tremendous violence, killed three members of the community, macheted three people, kidnapped people, threatened people. Berta herself had to live underground when there were charges brought against her that basically amounted to sedition. One of the charges was that she was a threat to the national security of Honduras, and there was an arrest warrant out for her. So her life hung by a thread and continues to, in part because of this work in Rio Blanco. But they won. Janine, it took a couple of years, but the World Bank pulled out, and the largest dam company in the world, which is the Chinese government-owned Sinohydral, pulled out, and the river is free-flowing, and it is undammed, and it is back to belonging to the indigenous peoples.
Many Americans do see themselves as environmentalists, perhaps as frustrated environmentalists, and media, I think, could serve them better by showing connections, not just between what their U.S. government does, you know, in other countries and that the impact of that, but also showing the connections between their environmental concerns and, you know, sure, what light bulb they use, but also much more so ways to show support for social movements in, for example, Honduras, to see that as part of what you as an individual can do in terms of your environmental action.
I absolutely agree. One thing that we have to do if we are going to be global citizens to really enforce the protection of human life and that of the earth is to look at the underpinnings of what environmental degradation is about. Yes, it's about our driving our cars, etc., but it's also about these U.S. corporations backed by U.S. Government that are allowed to run roughshod over people's lands in the name of, again, profit.
We've been speaking with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds. Find their work online at otherworldsarepossible.org. Beverly Bell, there's a great deal more we could talk about today, but unfortunately we'll have to end it here. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Janine, thank you, and I appreciate so much the great work that you all do at Counterspin.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.